Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
A liberal landslide. Justin Trudeau becomes Canada's next Prime Minister in an historic election that gave the Liberal Party a majority government with 184 seats. McLean's political editor Paul Wells helps us break down how the Liberals won, what went wrong for the Conservatives, and how the NDP support collapsed.
With the Conservative loss, Stephen Harper has stepped down as leader after 9 years as Prime Minister. The Tories have begun the process to start a leadership race, and one name that is popping up is former Toronto mayoral candidate Doug Ford. Doug joins us on the show to discuss the potential of a leadership run.
Who better to also reflect on the election than the people who helped run the campaigns? We have a special War Room panel with Kate Purchase, the Director of Communications to Prime Minister-designate Justin Trudeau, Conservative spokesperson Corey Tenaik, and the campaign director for the NDP, Anne McGrath.
And finally, there has been a lot of turnover with this campaign. We speak with some outgoing and incoming MPs, including an ousted high-profile cabinet minister and a star candidate who could be in line for a cabinet post.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
Canadians from all across this great country sent a clear message tonight. It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
That's Prime Minister-designate Justin Trudeau after an historic election win on Monday in the longest campaign in modern Canadian history. After 78 days, when all the ballots were counted, the Liberals pulled off a surprising victory, rising from the lows of 2011 to take a stunning 184 seats for a majority government. It's the first time in our country's history a party has risen from third-party status to take a majority government.
It's clear Canadians chose Trudeau as the agent for change against a Conservative Party and a Prime Minister that had governed for nearly a decade. With his wife and mother in the front row and thrilled supporters all around him, a triumphant Justin Trudeau gave his victory speech in Montreal.
We beat fear with hope. We beat cynicism with hard work. We beat negative, divisive politics with a positive vision that brings Canadians together.
The Conservatives had urged voters to avoid change and warned against the fiscal and social policies of their opponents, but Canadians didn't heed their calls. Stephen Harper could only lead the Tories to victory in 99 ridings, and he graciously conceded defeat.
For the 42nd time in 148 years, Canadians have chosen a national parliament. Well, tonight's result is certainly not the one we had hoped for. The people are never wrong. Canadians have accepted a liberal, have elected a liberal government, a result we accept without hesitation. I have spoken, friends, to Mr. Trudeau and offered him my congratulations, all of our congratulations, on his successful campaign.
In a statement from the party, it was then announced Harper had stepped down as Conservative leader, although he would remain on as MP.
For the NDP, it was a heartbreaking evening. The party came so close to power in its historic win in 2011, and it was leading in the polls for the first half of the campaign, but its support went into a free fall, and the party was thrust back down to third place with 44 seats. Instead of an orange wave, it was merely an orange splash. Despite the loss, NDP leader Thomas Mulcair promised to continue to fight for the issues he campaigned on.
New Democrats will make real and lasting progress in this new parliament. With this election, Canadians have asked us all to work for them. We will not let them down.
It was a long, hard-fought battle that led to this majority Liberal government. And McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, has summed it up in a mini-novel which looks at the Liberal surge, the Conservative fall, and the NDP collapse. It's called The Making of a Prime Minister, Inside Trudeau's Epic Victory. It's a 20,000-word review of the campaign, which you can now read in this week's edition of McLean's on Newsstands Now.
To speak more about Election 42, I sat down with McLean's political editor, Paul Wells.
How did the Liberals pull it off?
Justin Trudeau won the battle of ideas. That sounds like a crazy thing to say. But the debate in this election was about small versus large government. It's the debate that Stephen Harper chose and was pushing at the end with those game show style appearances where they listed all the cost of a larger, more ambitious federal government under Justin Trudeau. I think Canadians were well aware of that, and they said, yeah, we'll take that, thanks very much. We would like a federal government that wants to do more. We would like a federal government that wants to do more now, even at the cost of some deficit spending, which is how Trudeau managed to outflank the NDP and Tom Mulcair. And to the extent that the campaign sort of got sidelined on a weird debate about values and the way we treat new Canadians, Trudeau won that too. One of the most extraordinary statistics is that in the ridings in the country with the highest level of immigrant voters, almost all of them went Liberal. That's why we haven't heard from Jason Kenney in the last 3 days.
On Justin Trudeau, do you think in the campaign his opponents underestimated him?
Not only his opponents, certain journalists underestimated him. I spent a year telling everyone why he was likely not to win. But it's becoming one of the strongest rules in Canadian politics that the surest path to power is the assumption on the part of your opponents that you'll never make it. Tom Mulcair treated him with naked contempt in the later debates and kept losing. NDP organizers have told me that part of their problem was every time Mulcair criticized Trudeau, it upset NDP supporters, because NDP supporters' second choice vote was always Trudeau. I think Harper took Trudeau seriously and believed he was a serious threat and was worth addressing. He started advertising against Trudeau the day after Trudeau became the Liberal leader. But he never found his game. Harper was never able to think dispassionately about Trudeau the way he did about Trudeau's predecessors. And he was never able to unlock the combination to change people's perceptions of Trudeau.
How did the Conservatives lose? What did they do wrong? And how did their support drop?
Well, some pollsters, I'm thinking of ECOS, were picking up a desire for change a year ago. Very strong desire for change. And despite that, support for this Harper government was often quite high. And there was a period as late as 2 weeks before the election, it was reasonable to think that the Conservatives could still win this election. I was writing the Conservatives were going to win this election 2 weeks before it happened. But a few things. They were childishly simplistic in their prosecution of the case against the Trudeau government. They didn't engage a real debate on the proper role of government. And it turns out all of the things about Harper's style and way of communicating, his reclusiveness, his secretiveness, his odd choice of people he associates himself with, all the stuff that Conservatives knew bugged a lot of Canadians but really never got around to changing, it turned out to be fatal to the Conservative campaign and not just an annoyance.
The Conservatives are now framing this as the fact that Canadians chose, still supported the Conservative Party, but just didn't like Stephen Harper. They're putting it all on the leader's shoulders and looking towards the future. Do you think that that's the case?
I would very much argue the contrary. There's a reason why Stephen Harper is the sixth longest serving prime minister in the history of the country, why he won three elections, why he was able to grow from the narrowest and most precarious minority since Confederation to a majority in his fourth campaign. And Conservatives need to be careful. They don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's true that his style was sometimes abrasive, but they're free to turn him into Canada's most hated man. But there had not been a Conservative leader as successful electorally. There had not been as much of a winner in the various Conservative parties that Canada has had since Robert Borden in 1914. If Conservatives want to screw with that heritage, they're welcome to. The Liberals will be happy to govern while they're messing around.
All right, let's focus on the NDP for a minute. Some suggest that the NDP collapse is the reason the Liberals were able to pull this off. Is that the case in your eyes? And what happened to the NDP support?
The NDP campaign result has got to be heartbreaking for New Democrats, because you can't point to a day when Tom Mulcair did something big and wrong. He's an extraordinary debater. He's poised. He's eloquent in both languages. People liked him. But again, the question was, what idea of government, what big idea of government do we want to have? And because Mulcair essentially muted his ideas about government, he wanted to inherit power from Stephen Harper. he didn't really engage that debate. I'm inclined to think that they should hang on to him, let him try again. He seems to want to stay. It's worth reminding people that the NDP's share of the popular vote in Jack Layton's first three campaigns, 04, 06, and 08, was 16%, 17%, and 18% of the popular vote. It took four elections to build that big wave in 2011, and I think Tom Mulcair has earned the right to try again.
The length of the campaign, how did that play a factor?
It's interesting. The two big strategic choices that Stephen Harper made were to have the longest campaign in modern Canadian history and to have a lot of debates to talk Justin Trudeau into the ground. The length of the campaign allowed a very modest rate of increase in Liberal support to be enough to put him over the top. If it had been a shorter campaign, he would not have won. And all those debates turned out to be advertisements for Justin Trudeau. So the two big bets that Harper made to beat Trudeau ended up being the two of the things that beat Harper.
Justin Trudeau is now taking over the reins in the middle of a transition. It's probably not going to be so easy for him. What are the challenges that the Liberals now face? They're in a honeymoon period at the moment, but that will wear off.
Trudeau faces essentially the normal question or the normal challenges of a new government. He promised a lot of things. He seems to be intent on trying to implement them all, which is to his honor. But he'll find that it's difficult. It's way easier to say that he's going to heal the relationship between the Canadian government and the Crown and Canada's First Nations. But he would hardly be the first Prime Minister to try. It's easy to suggest that electoral reform's on the way. But that debate has bogged down other governments before his. 140 of his MPs have never been members of parliament before. Most of them are very impressive people who are not used to waiting in line for a promotion, and so he's going to have to keep some egos in check. He's already shown that he is a superior manager and organizer, at least against what people thought they could expect from him. There's no reason to assume he's going to be running a lousy or shoddy administration. But the challenges that he's facing are challenges that would test any prime minister. And so he's in for an interesting time.
And finally, where do the Conservatives go from here?
In France, Charles de Gaulle created a whole new system of government, wrote a new constitution for France. And the big question in French politics was, what's going to happen after de Gaulle leaves? And it wasn't until and after he retired that people found out whether the whole system was viable. I raise that because Stephen Harper invented the modern Conservative Party. It did not exist 18 months before he became its leader. And he's its only leader. And his handpicked people have been the party presidents. There is no internal democracy in that party. They have to spend a lot of time thinking about what they want to be when they grow up. And they don't actually have all that much time. I mean, 4 years... is not a luxurious excess amount of time if your mission is to rethink a party that's only ever had one leader.
That was Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells. Remember to check out his 20,000-word review of the campaign, which you can find online or in this week's issue of Maclean's.
Still to come on the show, we speak with Doug Ford about a possible bid to replace Stephen Harper as Conservative leader, we sit down with war room strategists from the campaigns of the three major parties, and we speak with incoming and outgoing MPs.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we speak about the election with the people who helped run the campaigns for each of the major parties, and we hear from outgoing and incoming MPs. But first,
the Conservatives have been humbled. After nearly 10 years in government, the Tories are heading back to the opposition benches. The party is now beginning a review of its losing campaign, and with Harper leaving, it is now looking for a new leader. Longtime Ontario MP Diane Finley has officially put her name forward to become interim leader until the membership can choose its new full-time leader. It's believed the Conservatives could be making that choice in the spring, and many names are being tossed around as possible contenders, including former ministers Jason Kenney, Lisa Raitt, Tony Clement, Kelly Leach, and Michelle Rempel.
Some big names outside the House of Commons are actually ruling themselves out of the race, such as former Quebec Premier Jean Charest, current Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall, and another son of a former Prime Minister, Mark Mulroney. But there is one high-profile person from outside Parliament that is still on the fence about whether or not to run. I was able to speak on the phone with former Toronto mayoral candidate and councillor Doug Ford. What do you think the Conservative Party did wrong in this campaign? Why do you think they fell?
Well, I think it's very simple. The NDP tanked, and I've studied these numbers inside and out, at least in our area, in the GTA. The NDP tanked, and the election was too long. If the Prime Minister would have called the election 4 weeks ago, he'd still be Prime Minister, in my opinion. I was looking at the polling numbers. I knew we weren't going to do well, but the difference between ourselves and Rob, all the political insiders, even his own team, some people, were circling him like a shark. There was blood in the water, and everyone, jumped ship. And Rob and Doug Ford always jump in to try to help out any way we can.
There were a lot of pundits who said that campaigning at the end was a desperation move.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Do you think it was a desperation move in the end?
No, not at all. And it's funny that people aren't reporting that 4 days before the last election, when he was ahead in the polls, he came to Rob and asked if Rob could come out to an event. And but no one wanted to comment because he ended up winning.
But to be fair, a lot had changed from 2011 to this election with the story of your brother. There were many different controversial remarks, his issue with drugs, all of that came after the 2011 election, which is why the situation has changed and why it was called a desperation move.
No, I don't call myself having 9% more than all the Conservative candidates combined a desperate move. As much as the media may not want to admit it, or the political insiders and the political establishment, they just don't want to admit that Rob and I have one of the largest bases in the country. I don't know too many people that ended up with 330,000 votes. In Rob's case, it was a lot higher. So they can say what they want. They know our base is strong. The Liberals know that 47% of the traditional Liberal voters vote for us, and the NDP know 40%. That's why Mr. Mulcair wasn't saying a word.
There was also a lot of talk about bad blood within the Conservative camp. Could organization have also been a major factor in this election loss?
I thought they were doing a pretty good job. I'm disappointed that Jason Kenney would want to throw his boss underneath the bus and start throwing dirty laundry out there the night of the election, saying that publicly. Usually, no matter if you're NDP, Liberal, Green Party, Conservative, you sort out your problems internally. You don't run out and start throwing your boss underneath the bus and the Conservative Party underneath the bus like Jason Kenney did. I just think, when the momentum happens, everyone knows it's hard to stop momentum in the last week of the election. So I think it just comes down to two simple facts. Call the election earlier, and the NDP tanked.
In this interview so far, you've talked about the diversity of Ford Nation. You've thrown back criticism at one of the people who's perceived to be one of the possible leadership candidates for the Federal Conservative Party now that Harper is gone. But are you considering maybe taking a shot at the leadership of the Federal Conservatives? Your name has been thrown out there before.
Well, I think it's a little premature right now, Cormac. It's a big decision for anyone. And the only reason, I'll criticize someone is, when they go after your own party before, right after the election. We don't believe in doing that. We believe in sitting down with the whole team. We have 99 strong members that are going to hold Justin Trudeau to account over the next 4 years. And we're just going to have to see how this plays out, and the party's going to put together a nominating committee. I believe they already have, and we're going to move forward with the party.
So are you talking to people right now? Are you considering your options? What's the status for you?
Well, I always consider my options. I never say never in politics. But again, it's a 4 to 8 year commitment, probably more than likely an 8 year commitment for anyone that wants to run for leader. And I have to weigh that out. I have to weigh that out with my family, number one, my business, number two, and the people that support me. But my phone has been ringing off the hook. So we'll see what happens.
Have you heard from any federal MPs who are urging you to run? I know you have supporters who want you to run. Have you heard from...
I have.
You have?
I have, and I'm not going to comment on who they are, because until or when or if I decide to, then they'd be more than happy to come out and publicly support me.
What would it take to get you to run?
Well, number one, my family supporting me, making this decision, my business, the team here and also in the U.S. divisions. And, you know, I'd speak to our supporters, our Ford Nation supporters, too, and see how they feel. But either way, I think the party's going to pick a great leader. We have some great candidates, and we'll come back as strong as ever. And we'll see what happens in the next 4 years. But by no means, Cormac, is it going to be easy. We have a challenge, and we have to rebuild the team. And again, we'll be there to make sure we hold Justin Trudeau and the Liberals accountable.
Regardless of whether you run or not, I know you'd probably have a comment on this question anyway. How do you think, what do you think needs to happen with the Conservative Party to fix it?
Well, Cormac, I don't think it was the Conservative values or the Conservative policies. I personally think, and I want to state this very clearly, I'm a massive supporter of the Prime Minister. I just thought that, you know, this started to get personal. People didn't see eye to eye with the Prime Minister. And that's federal and provincial elections are so much geared now on the leader, opposed to the actual policies and philosophies of a party. So I don't think the Conservative message was lost. I just think people wanted to change. And when people want to change, it's hard to change their mind.
That was former Toronto mayoral candidate Doug Ford speaking about the possibility of running for the leadership of the federal Conservatives.
Still to come on the show, some of the top war room strategists from the three major parties reflect on the campaign, and we speak with MPs who are both coming to and leaving from Ottawa.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we speak with some outgoing and incoming MPs, including an ousted high-profile cabinet minister and a star candidate who could be in line for a cabinet post. But first,
there are no better people in this country to break down what happened in this election than the people who actually helped run the campaigns for each of the three major parties. So just 2 days after the ballots were counted, McLean's hosted an event at the Chateau Laurier in Ottawa called What Just Happened. McLean's political editor Paul Wells sat down with three war room strategists, Liberal Director of Communications Kate Purchase, NDP Campaign Director Anne McGrath, and the chief spokesperson for the Conservatives, Corey Ten Eyck. Paul started the panel by asking that title question.
What just happened?
Well, I'm told that we won on Monday night, and I really do think that we were able to pull off the events of Monday night, partially because we had the best team, but also because we had the best platform, in my personal opinion, and an incredible leader. And I think that that contributed to the success, that obviously we had a plan going into this that we set in motion a little over two years ago, and we stuck to it. And through all of the ups and downs of the campaign, or pre-writ, frankly, and there were many of them in our party, but also in other parties, that you couldn't possibly know, but we had a plan. We knew the regions that we wanted to pick up in. We knew the program that we were going to be putting forward for the campaign, and so we were consistent and disciplined, and I think that was a big contributing factor. In addition to that, we had laid out multiple phases of the campaign. The first phase of the campaign, and this is not a plug for our hosts today, but it was to win the McLean's debate and fight our way back into the battle. And then at that point, it became a phase two was really focused on the NDP, where we wanted to prove that we were the real change agent, and that was partially through our platform, but it was also through our advertising and our ground game. And then phase three was all about wheeling on my friends in the Conservatives and just going hard for those last 2 weeks and building that kind of momentum that we were able to see. The ground game was a huge part of that for us. In the last 2 weeks of the campaign, that final barnstorm tour that we did, we picked up over a dozen ridings, and there was only one riding where the leader touched down that we didn't win that riding, which was Perth-Wellington. So that was a big focus. As well, our advertising strategy was integrated and part of the core strategy. And, you know, I like to think that it was particularly innovative. It was different and fresh and was a fresh voice. So that was a big thing. You know, it was all about really laying out that plan 2 years ago, knowing where our regions of strength were, but also where we truly believed, particularly in the urban west and lower mainland and Manitoba, where we thought we could surprise people. And that's what we focused on.
Anne McGrath, what will you remember many years from now about these 3 months?
That there was a long campaign. And I'm wondering when the early election timing speculation is going to begin for the next one. It was an incredibly long campaign. And it was even prior to the campaign starting, we were, you know, people were working really hard and getting ready and so forth. Everybody already knows that the stage was set at the very beginning for it to be a campaign about change. And I think that what happened to some extent was Canadians chose the agent, obviously Canadians chose the agent of that change. For the New Democrats, we had a lot of expectations going into the campaign. We were very hopeful about some of the things that we could achieve. And the results, I think, are mixed. I think that on the one hand, we have the second largest caucus we've ever had. We're a permanent and, I think, important fixture on the Canadian political landscape. We have 16 new members of parliament. We have MPs. Clearly, we have obvious roots in Quebec, where we have 16 members of parliament. And we're back in Saskatchewan, where we have three new MPs, one in Regina, one in Saskatoon, and one in the north. So really very good beachheads to build upon there. Clearly, though, in terms of our aspirations, we did not succeed in the things that we wanted to succeed in. And secondly, we experienced some losses that were devastating from personally and for everybody. I've been through lots of campaigns, and when you're successful, everybody says that was a flawless campaign. I heard that in 2011. You guys ran a flawless campaign. That was not a flawless campaign. And when you're not successful, everybody goes, the campaign was a disaster. Neither of those are true. So I would say congratulations to both my colleagues here, because we all ran very good campaigns, in my view. There were no serious and devastating errors in a lot of ways. There were certainly moments where I wish other decisions had been made, and I take full responsibility for that. But then on the other hand, I think that the NDP went in a position that we'd never been in before. I think we emerged from this with a lot of hope for where we can go from here. There will be lots and lots of discussion and analysis, and people will have ideas about what happened in the campaign and what we should do going forward. And I look forward actually to those discussions because I think we'll have a lot to learn from them. But we have a lot of opportunity going forward. And when Canadians chose change, they did choose the Mr. Trudeau and the Liberal Party, and they had some things in their platform that I think are very interesting and supportable. And we will be working hard to make sure that those things actually take place.
Okay, thanks very much for that. Corey Tanike, what was the Conservative campaign's objectives, and how did it do against those objectives?
Well, obviously, we didn't achieve the ultimate objective, which was to get reelected. But the Liberals obviously ran the best campaign in the sense that ultimately the ballot question that they presented to Canadians was the one that the majority of Canadians voted on and agreed to support. In terms of the overall election, I'd underline how difficult a challenge we had trying to win four back-to-back elections. That's something that has not been accomplished since 1908. So it was a very difficult challenge, I think, right out of the gates. I think that a large percentage of the electorate's heart had hardened on us, and the desire to not have us in office was greater than anything that we could put in the window vis-a-vis the economy or anything else. Our ballot question is pretty clear. It was on the side of our bus. It's about security and the economy. And which leader do you think is the best to be able to keep our economy strong and our country secure? And for basically a third of the electorate, about the same as we had on day one of the campaign, we had at the end of the campaign, the core constituency of the Conservative Party is, I think, made of granite at this point. And one thing that I think a lot of people have not given the Prime Minister credit for is, you know, his support for him as Prime Minister exceeded our ballot support right through to the very end of the campaign. So I think there is a lot to work with. We're really talking about if you shifted that vote a few points from the Liberals to ourselves, you would do well. The other thing I didn't mention, which I should have, is, look, the collapse of the NDP and the vote of the NDP was beyond anything that we thought was possible. The gamble that the Liberals took in tacking to the left of the NDP didn't really display, you know, a lot of, although they were, you know, vying for NDP voters with a very leftist policy, it wasn't having enough support fall off the other end of the wagon for them. And, you know, that's a surprising accomplishment for the Liberal campaign. And I'm not sure it would be possible to repeat if you were dealing with a government that had not been 9 years in office. I think it's not that people were overly comfortable with some of the things in the Liberal platform. It's that that was secondary to their desire for a change in government overall.
And I'll just bust if I don't ask this question. Why did you go to Etobicoke twice to rooms in the last week that contained Rob Ford?
Well, is there a list of people who are not allowed to attend Conservative Party events? Like, you know, I think the notion, you know, before there was Harper derangement syndrome, there was Ford derangement syndrome. And there is a media obsession with the Ford brothers, which is almost unprecedented. You know, the Fords have been supporters of the Conservative Party for their entire lives. Their political base is in Etobicoke. The fact that they would be at events that we have in the GTA is supremely normal. And the thought of not having them there is also unusual.
Yeah, the list of people who weren't allowed into Conservative events is actually really long.
We let you in, so obviously.
Anne McGrath, I want to put a question that was just put to me before this session. When it became clear a few weeks into this campaign that Justin Trudeau was coming up slowly but steadily and was going to be competitive with you guys as the change agent, why did you not unleash the hounds on him? Why did you not go hard negative on Justin Trudeau at the end of August?
I think that we were very clear from the very beginning and wanted to be quite clear that most Canadians did want change, and that so we were very clear that our opponent was the Conservative, was Stephen Harper and the Conservatives. And the other thing I think that it's fair to say is that every time that our leader or our campaign or our party is says anything critical of the Liberal Party, mm-hmm. or its leaders, we're under a certain level of critique for that. Even at the same time as Justin Trudeau was really attacking us openly all the time, every time you say something negative about the Liberals, many of our own supporters are not very happy when that happens. I think that there's certainly that. I think that we had the perception, we had the belief that Canadians wanted a new government, and they wanted a progressive, principled, and positive government. And that us going heavily negative against the, you know, what was at the time the third party, yep. would probably backfire.
Okay. There's a question I have for Anne and Kate, which is about that moment mid-September when the Federal Appeal Court panel releases the ruling on the NECAB. For Anne, I guess it's, what was the effect on the campaign? I mean, to some extent it's obvious, but, and for Kate, a thing that mystifies a lot of people, Justin Trudeau's position on the NECAB was identical. Why did he rise in Quebec while the NDP fell?
Well, from our point of view, I mean, we saw an immediate drop in support, particularly in the province of Quebec, and I think a lot of the progressive Canadians that were looking to us felt that the base level of support in Quebec was an important factor in supporting us, because they were looking for the best vehicle to replace Stephen Harper. So we did see an immediate drop in support. What was surprising, and I think that you're absolutely right, there was surprising, was that that drop in support in the early days didn't go into any one particular place. It went to a few different places. But I do think that a lot of Quebec voters, when the NECAP happened, took a second look. And so they weren't necessarily, in my view anyway, voting or expressing support on that particular issue, but it sort of shook them loose from where they had been. Mm-hmm. And then I think they went out and looked around. And so I don't think it was necessarily on that issue, but I do think that's what shook them loose from NDP support at the very beginning.
I do have to agree with Anne on that. I don't think that the NECAP issue was the issue that caused the fall in support for the NDP in Quebec. I think, frankly, not having a strong platform that represented a lot of Quebecers to pivot to was the issue there. And in terms of our position on the NECAP, this was something that Mr. Trudeau had been speaking about for months and months and months. But I don't think that was necessarily the turning point for the NDP. I don't think that Canadians felt as strongly about it. Or that Quebecers felt as strongly about it as the people in this room all sort of believed.
That was Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells, speaking with Liberal Director of Communications, Kate Purchase, NDP Campaign Director, Anne McGrath, and the Chief Spokesperson for the Conservatives, Corey Tenike.
Coming up after the break, we check in with a couple of outgoing MPs and a new one who could jump straight into cabinet. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
After every election, there are, of course, winners and losers. Longtime MPs or even high-profile cabinet ministers sometimes lose their seats. Meanwhile, star candidates from other parties can make big splashes. We end our show checking in with some of the successful and unsuccessful candidates of this election. Finance Minister Joe Oliver lost his seat to Liberal Marco Mendicino in a hard-fought campaign in the riding of Eglinton-Lawrence. Oliver was an important figure in the Conservative government, and he tells Maclean senior writer Laura Payton he's not sour about his loss.
How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good. I mean, obviously, when one enters a highly competitive contest, you want to win. But that wasn't to be, and so I'm... I'm sort of reflecting now on what I and what our government accomplished, and I feel pretty good about that. And I also feel very grateful for having had the opportunity to represent the people of Eglinton-Lawrence at Parliament. It's a tremendous honor, and for having been appointed by the Prime Minister as Minister of Natural Resources and Minister of Finance.
And what do you do now? You've got an accomplished career. I believe you're 75, I read. Is this a time where you kind of, I don't know, sit back and go to a cottage? Or are you making plans to do something else in business?
Well, I don't have any immediate plans, but, I have an extensive background in the private sector and now in the public sector, and I want to continue to contribute in whatever way I can that's meaningful. It's not for today, but at some point I want to be engaged. I like to write and I like to talk, so maybe there'll be some opportunities, but I think I'm going to be able to do it in a less charged environment.
Independent Brent Rathgaber left the Conservative Party after several disagreements with the Prime Minister's office. While Rathgaber hoped to retain his seat, he fell to the candidate from the party he left. Speaking with me over the phone, Rathgaber reflects on how difficult it was to run without a party name attached to his campaign.
How often did you hear or did you hear from people that said that didn't feel like there was any reason to vote for an independent candidate?
Oh, lots. I mean, it's a real mental leap, which I'm still sort of perplexed about, because municipally in Alberta we don't have parties.
Mm-hmm.
So people have some familiarity with voting for candidates. But I can't tell. I mean, I don't, at least 20 times in a 200 house door knocking shift, you would get that. You know, what's the advantage of voting for independents? You know, some people didn't even. In fact, some people said, "You can do that. You can be run as an independent. You don't have to be affiliated with a party." So. Yeah, no, it was a major mental hurdle for people to abandon what is their normal, and that is to vote for either Party A, Party B, or Party C. This is something that they had to, first of all, think that they could do, and then B, decide if they wanted to do it. And, you know, that's obviously why so few independents get elected. Mm-hmm. So the reality is, and I mean, I think political sciences have shown this, that in a federal or provincial election, you know, most candidates are probably 5% of the equation, maybe 10% if they're really, really good or really, really bad, but that 90% of the people vote based on the leader or the party or some combination thereof. I'm sure you've seen those surveys, so that's it took a lot to get people out of that thinking.
But when you get out with the old, that means there's in with the new. There are a lot of fresh faces heading to Parliament. Many may even make it to cabinet, like Liberal Melanie Joly. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes asked Joly about the younger grits and rookie Liberals who now make up a bulk of the MPs on the government side of the House.
I think that because of the open nomination process, a lot of people that really believe in the democratic vision of Mr. Trudeau of rebuilding the party from grassroots, from, you know, bottom up, was interesting to a lot of people that were political neophytes, but at the same time that believe in the power of politics and that could organize themselves to win an open nomination and then gain enough trust in themselves and in their team to afterwards win an election. So, and I think also that we've been using a lot of social media targeting specifically young people to show how much it was important for them to vote. I personally was I created one of the first incubators here in Quebec that was called Génération d'idées. That was in 2007, and it was aimed to give a voice to people aged between 20 and 35, a lot of people that were involved around this political think tank and others are now, you know, walking the talk and getting involved.
Melanie, a lot of what you've talked about, although I'm not arguing with the fact that it's very important, the idea of engaging people, getting people into the democratic process, it's sort of involved in elections, right, and in that part of politics, but now you guys have to run a government. How do you feel about your own preparation for being, you know, probably an important member of a new government? Do you feel like you've got the background and the skills that could help you be a cabinet minister?
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting. I wrote a book about the importance of getting involved in politics, and it was published a year ago, actually. And I think that when you look at it, 50 years ago, Mr. Robert Bourassa, the premier of Quebec, the former premier of Quebec, was age 36, my age, when he became first premier. Jean Drapeau was 37 when he became mayor of Montreal, and John F. Kennedy was the same age as Mr. Trudeau when he became president.
After Monday's election, there are nearly 200 new MPs, the most rookies to jump to Parliament since the 1993 election. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.